and I will I think I can boil the issue in this case down to, I think, a fairly narrow issue, and that I did that after reading through all the cases, again, mainly the cases out of the Ninth Circuit that deal with the emergency doctrine. In this case, we're dealing with the decision of the police to enter a hotel room through a window based on a four-day-old missing persons report. The person had been gone from her residence for approximately 6 days. Her mother had called into the police department, not 911, not the dispatch asking for immediate assistance, but reported it to the police as a missing persons report 2 days after she had been missing. And I think,
The record doesn't show what caused that involuntary word to be added to the report.
Not at all. In fact, Sergeant Tolma stated at the hearing he didn't know what it meant, called dispatch. They didn't know what the word involuntary meant. As we know, it could have meant the mother didn't want her to go.
But the report, if I'm recalling it, did indicate it had the word suicidal in it, and it had the word drugs, and it had prostitution. So it had some association with those three elements in addition to her being missing.
It signified certain factors that were involved in the missing persons report, but when you go to the missing persons report itself, it really describes in detail what the mother was really concerned about, was that she left with some unknown person in a hatchback vehicle and hadn't heard from her for days. The guy was connected to somebody who was in jail for murder, and that she had called her saying, I'm hallucinating and tweaking out, and I have a gun in the house. No indication that the gun was taken with her. So when you read the contents of the missing persons report, those are just what was contained in the missing persons report was a signification that said risk factors, not that these things were actually occurring. And I think that's important in this case, because as I read through the Ninth Circuit cases, beginning with Russell, I submitted a brief letter or a supplemental letter to the court in February, I believe, talking about the Russell case. In that case, the police responded immediately to a 911 call. So this was a 911 call asking for immediate assistance. In the Martinez case, Russell's at 436 Fed 3rd 1086. And then there's the United States versus Martinez case, which is at 406 Fed 3rd 1160. Again, that was a 911 call asking for immediate assistance on a domestic violence call. The Brooks case, which was authored by Judge Gould, which is at 367 Fed 3rd 1128. Again, that's a 911 call on a domestic disturbance. And that case is, I think Brooks is important because it says what the standard is that in order to determine whether the police have a right to go in, there has to be a fair probability or substantial chance that what they believe is the emergency is actually occurring. And in this case, what you have is a hotel room occupied by somebody with a do not disturb deadbolt engaged, and not answering the door when the police knock on the door and announce that they're the police. It's obviously somebody in the room who doesn't want to be disturbed.
Not obviously somebody. The room was taken and registered in the name of Tanya
Selke.
Selke, right?
Correct.
So they had reason to believe that it was Tanya Selke who was in the room, right?
I would agree with that.
I mean, that's not a name that somebody else would take as a pseudonym like James Jones, right?
I completely agree with that. Yes.
If they have reason to believe that a missing person is in the room who may be suicidal, is that enough for the emergency doctrine?
I don't believe in this case, Your Honor, because the police are not responding to an urgent call by a father like was happened in the Martin versus Oceanside. It's not the call, the report by the mother is to the police department, not asking for immediate assistance, not saying these things are immediately apparent with her daughter, but saying, I haven't seen my daughter for 2 days, and here's what she said 2 days ago, with a report that wasn't asking them for immediate assistance to go out and look for her daughter. It was simply a report that my daughter's out there, and here's some of the things that she's been that has gone on in her life. And
you don't think that a mother reporting to the police that her daughter is suicidal and using drugs and is engaged in prostitution is a request for immediate assistance?
Your Honor, I don't know if that's what she reported, because the narrative of that police report doesn't say that's what she reported. What it had in there was risk factors. What her report to the police was that narrative where she talked about going to the house because her daughter called and said, I'm hallucinating.
Did the police have the full narrative or just the name and the three words?
They had that screen, and I attached that to appendix. I believe it's appendix B to my opening brief. It was an exhibit that was admitted at the hearing. So what the police had in the patrol car was reflected in appendix B to my opening brief, and it said suicidal, drug use, prostitution. But what also was in that was the phone number to the police records department where they could have called the police and got more detail on what the missing persons report was all about. Sergeant Thomas said, well, that's not what we normally do, but it's certainly in a situation like this where it's not a call for immediate assistance. In fact, the manager didn't give the police any information that Ms. Selke was acting abnormal or in any way suicidal or on drugs at the time they met with the hotel manager. So they had ways in which they could have developed this without deciding at that moment to open the curtain and create an exigency with Ms. Eyinger, who ran to the bathroom. So I think it really does boil down to as to what the difference between this case is that in each of the cases that are cited in our briefs are the police officers responding immediately to the information that is given them either through 911, through dispatch, or in the case dealing with the Bradley case dealing with the 9-year-old boy is so different than a case here dealing with a 30-year-old adult who decides that she doesn't want to talk to her mother. It's so different because you have a 9-year-old, you have the police at the home arresting the mother, knowing that the 9-year-old is in the home alone, or at least have a strong likelihood that the 9-year-old is in the home, checks with the neighbor, which is the only other place the 9-year-old could have been, and then comes back and goes in the home to check on the welfare of a 9-year-old who's unsupervised. This is different than a 30-year-old female who, I think we can infer, doesn't necessarily need supervision and doesn't want supervision. It's so that the facts in this case, it's not a call for immediate assistance. It's a report to the police saying these are some of the things that is going on in my daughter's life and I'm concerned, and it's okay for the mother to be concerned, but does that give the police officers a right to open a window and storm into the window of the hotel room? I think it boils down to that.
Mr. Hornell, would you like to keep some rebuttal time?
Thank you.
Mr. Stivvy.
Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, the basic foundation for this type of warrantless entry is that police have to be able to respond to emergency situations pursuant to their community caretaking functions. The appropriateness of the emergency doctrine, as is reflected in the Bradley case, has to be determined after looking at the facts and circumstances of each individual case. And when we look at the facts and circumstances of this cause, the conclusion has to be that those officers had no choice but to make entry into that hotel room.
Well, I'm not so convinced of that, man. What is an emergency situation when they're expecting a possibility of suicide, if that's the emergency, because drug use and prostitution doesn't seem to me to be that much of an emergency? What looks suicidal when the police observe a man in boxer shorts and a woman fully dressed and they're going into a bathroom? Suicide usually occurs alone, right? How does that jibe with the idea we're trying to prevent a suicide by climbing in the window? Please explain that to me.
Your Honor, I believe the exigency probably would have had to be developed before the officers opened that window and pulled aside the curtain. and it's the totality of the circumstances that they were faced with. I have to respectfully disagree as far as the suicidal potential tendencies of Ms. Selke being the only factor. I believe that drug use, especially when Ms. Selke's mother had advised law enforcement officers that Ms. Selke was basically hallucinating. She was taking so many drugs to the point that she asked her mother to come over and take her children away from her. I think the officers...
All of that wasn't known to these policemen. All they had was three words: suicidal, drugs, and prostitution. Those are the three words. What about what they saw through the window can be reasonably concluded, and then I'm going to ask you what the reason is, as to why there was a threat of suicide by a fully dressed woman and a man in boxer shorts going from the hotel room where the television was on into the bathroom?
Your Honor, I think there would be less of a concern at that point once the officer saw that.
About what are they concerned? Suicide? Two people going into a bathroom that they're both going to suicide, or just she's going to suicide?
As I'm saying, Judge, once the officer looked into the room and saw a fully clothed woman and the man standing there, there was less likelihood, if any likelihood, that there was about to be a suicide there. But at that point, the officers were at risk themselves, which is why they went through that window.
Well, what was the risk themselves? The people inside the hotel room weren't opening the door. Were the police at risk because they weren't opening the door?
They were.
Some security issue?
They were at risk, Your Honor, because Ms. Eihinger fled to a part of the room where the officers couldn't see. In those circumstances, I believe officers always have to be concerned about their own safety, about someone going for a gun. They had just had the prior circumstance where they were not only...
So it was going for a gun, not suicide, that made the officers feel they had a security risk for themselves and propelled them through the window. Is that your argument?
That's part of it, Judge. The other part of it was Sergeant Toma's observation that sometimes, if there is a risk of suicide, persons do it by cop, suicide by cop. So besides...
Suicide by?
Cop. C-O-P.
Suicide by inducing the police to shoot them.
Correct. Exhibiting a weapon...
Both people going into a bathroom increase the risk that one of them is going to be shot by a cop?
Mr. Allen didn't go into the bathroom, Your Honor. Only Ms. Eihinger did. And that was Sergeant Toma's testimony, that he was concerned for those different officer safety reasons.
Does the record tell us whether the observing officer at the window was observed by the people inside?
There's no direct indication of that other than Ms. Eihinger fleeing to the back of the room, Judge.
Other than what?
Ms. Eihinger fleeing to the back of the hotel room into the back bathroom.
Okay. So it's clear she's fleeing, at least from the officer's perspective. She's fleeing from observing him as opposed to just going into the bathroom.
Yes, Judge. This is a small room.
Right.
Where the officers have just got done kicking on the door to the point that guests are coming out of other rooms.
They banged on the door. No one's answered. Now they open the window.
Correct, Judge.
They're observed.
In a very small room, as the diagram that I submitted with my brief, Judge, shows that the window was right next to the door. Officers slide that open, pull back the curtain, there'd be no way that they couldn't observe the police officer.
I have a picture of that now.
Your Honor, the only other point I'd like to address is Mr. Hormel has put a lot of emphasis on the fact that this is a four-day-old report. I believe because you have to look at each case on its own merits, that doesn't necessarily doesn't resolve the issue at all. The question is whether there was an exigency as a result of the information that these officers had. These missing persons report are a high priority with the department. There was testimony by Sergeant Toma that once Crime Check takes a missing person report, it's immediately faxed over to the records section and then displayed to officers out in the field on their computer screens. And there are also follow-up done on these missing persons reports so they don't just languish in a file and they pop up 6 months later. At page 60 of the excerpt of record, there's some testimony from a gentleman from the records section who talked about or testified concerning follow-up reports or follow-up contacts by the police to check out if the person still is a missing person. And there was actually a subtle slip done in this case on the 15th showing that the police were very diligent in following up on this missing person report. That's all I had, Your Honors.
We appreciate it. Mr. Skibbe. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Ormel.
Unless the Court has any questions, stand on that.
Let's see. Any questions? No, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
United States versus Allen shall be submitted. Again, we thank counsel for traveling from Eastern Washington to be here with us. Thank you. The Court will recess for 10 minutes because we're setting up a video.
All rise. This Court stands adjourned.